This episode is brought to you by the Master of Arts in Catholic Education program at the Augustine Institute Graduate School of Theology. Dedicated to the renewal of Catholic education, this degree equips school teachers and administrators to bring Christ to the center of every classroom through a focus on sacred scripture, theology, Christian anthropology, and the traditional liberal arts. Learn more at augustine.edu/MACE. Father Joseph Fessio is the founder and editor of Ignatius Press, whose books we've often covered here on the podcast. He has a long and distinguished record of supporting Catholic education, including leadership at Ave Maria University. He joins us to discuss a new book from Ignatius Press, authored by one of our favorites here at First Things, Robert Cardinal Serra. And the topic is another favorite, Pope Benedict the 16th. It is called He Gave Us So Much, a tribute to Benedict 16th. Welcome, Father Fessio.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
Let me open with a short sentence in a long quotation from Benedict early in the book. Quote, talking to God, that is praying, implies talking about God. I understood that when we pray, we automatically assume certain notions of God, of who he is. You pray, you're automatically sort of in a posture towards something that you have conceived, envisioned. Did Benedict thus maintain that the priest's role is to guide or contain people's assumptions about God? I mean, real at a fundamental level.
Absolutely. And of course, he was a teacher, first of all, and he himself was immersed in prayer, I would say. I knew him well. He was my doctoral director. He was born, as you know, on the vigil of Easter, Holy Saturday. In those days, they celebrated that feast in the morning in some places. He was born at 4:30 in the morning on Holy Saturday. His mother takes him 4 hours later to the vigil. So he's baptized at the Easter Vigil on Holy Saturday, a few hours after he was born. So he looked upon that as a symbolic moment, that he was born at the heart of the Church of the liturgical year. So he was always someone who was close to the Lord and felt prayer was critical. And by the way, we call him Carlo Serra. Most people say Serra because that's the English way you do it. But he's he was born in Guinea, which is a French-speaking country because of the French colonization there. So in France, as you know, all words are pronounced in the last syllable. So he would call himself Sarah in French. We call him Sarah because it rhymes with hurrah.
Very good. Very good. Well, but, so does this mean, must everyone from the Pope all the way down to the RCIA tutor always return to the issue of who God is, the being of God?
That's right. And that's how the Baltimore Catechism starts, you know. It was pretty wise for them to do so. But obviously, he's the beginning and the end. So if you want to start at the beginning, you have to start with him. Not the Big Bang. That came after.
Yes. And nothing comes from nothing, right? So Cardinal Serra follows this little quotation where Benedict emphasizes who is God, with another passage from Benedict written not long after Vatican II, where he regrets that the liturgy is turning into a, quote, show. That's the word that he uses, a show, quote, people trying to make religion interesting. That was pretty fast. Benedict already, I mean, right after Vatican II, he was worried about what people were going to do with this momentous.
Well, he was very perceptive, as you know, Mark, and because he was at Vatican II, he knew the personalities there. He knew what was going on. he knew there were some time bombs that were put there in those texts, and some of the people there were just waiting to use them as a pretext to make changes which were not really authorized by the council. So I think even before the council ended, he was aware of the problems that were going to arise. By the way, I think he wrote a wonderful book, well, a series of radio lectures in 1969 and 1970, which we published as The Faith and the Future. And he talks there over 50 years ago about the future of the church in the last chapter. And it's very prophetic. The man really had great wisdom.
Yeah. Was Benedict one of the first to be dismayed at the, quote, relevance interpretation of Vatican II?
Well, Mark, how could I possibly know that? I mean, I don't know who the first people were that had that thought, but it came pretty fast to people like him. I think de Lubac, for sure, was aware of it, Balthasar, Bouillet, those European theologians who really had been the foundation of the council's, many of its teachings, they saw it going astray early on.
Well, Maritain, Father, too. With your lengthy experience that few people possess in the church for a long time, now, what was the, we're stepping out of the book for a moment, what was this relevance need? What were the people think they were doing when they say the church has to become more relevant to the world? What was their motive there? What did they conceive of themselves as doing?
I'm not a psychologist or a sociologist, Mark, but you know, it was kind of a perfect storm in the sense that we had the media had become very pervasive, so everybody knew what was going on instantaneously. We had the sex revolution in the 60s coinciding with the council almost. That was a time, we had 1968, you know, with the riots in France and in Europe. So everything seemed to converge there on this idea that we have to look into the future. What is going on in the past? Is it relevant for us now? Question authority, that was on the bumper stickers, you know. And so in a certain sense, I'm a man of the council, but in a sense, it came at the wrong time. It came just when there was societal, especially in the West, there were societal upheavals taking place and people were all in favor of change. Plus the fact, as you know, we live in an age where everybody thinks progress is something which is natural to everything, not just technology, but the human morals and the human flourishing. But it's not the case. We falsely think that because our phones are more, you know, improved by next year, that we can improve our human faculties or even make them more technologized, as your friend, I'm not your friend, but Harari of the World Economic Forum, who talks about Homo Deus, you know, man God. Well, there is a man God. His name is Jesus Christ. But trying to become Christ ourselves by implanting chips in our brains is not the path to the future.
I seem to recall something from the past about a couple of people being, or a woman actually, being promised, "You shall become as a god." Something along those lines. Yeah, I don't know what happened after that, but. There we are. Cardinal Seurat makes much of Benedict's motto, God is, you know, and is emphasized right there. What makes that simple assertion so powerful and central and not just, hey, God is?
That's a characteristic of rational. I think if you're going to call him a theologian of any kind, you call him a fundamental theologian. He's always going back into the roots of things. Like his first encyclical, God is Love, he went back to the Greeks, back to the idea of Eros even, and showing that love is fundamental. But we haven't even been doing this recording, Mark, on a day when I just finished the Office of Readings, and it was Exodus 3, where Moses sees the bush on fire, but the bush isn't burning. And he says, well, if I'm going to lead these people out of Egypt, who should... And they ask me, what's your name? What's your name? I am who I am. I mean, that's the beginning of the great metaphysical revelation of the being of God. But in the very next sentence, in the previous sentence too, I'm the God of your father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So here we have metaphysics, philosophy, united with history. God is being. He's also the one who enters into history, which he creates, because he is, as you said, nothing comes from nothing. So, I mean, and Ratzinger was, again and again, he would say that the cause of our ills today is a lack of faith in God. That's the ultimate root of it. He's got that essay, which is in the book there, on the crisis of, you know, sexual predation by priests. And he says the problem is a loss of faith. So, yes, I mean, he always is going back to that fundamental principle of faith. And what is faith in? Faith is in God. God is.
God is. Cardinal Seurat highlights one particular feature of Benedict, and that is his childlike spirit. I'll ask you, did you observe the same thing?
Yes, in Benedict? Completely. I mean, he's just, it was a beautiful paradox. Here's this brilliant man who was so simple, serene, had the kind of wonder of a child, and so direct. I mean, really, he was, I mean, I think he was the same. I don't think every pope should be canonized, especially these days, but he was, no one who worked with him would say anything other than he was a very holy man. And that holiness showed it in a kind of a childlike simplicity that was there, even though he was so, you know, so highly educated and so cultured.
Yeah, yeah. He does warn, though, that we not understand God the Father on the model of human fatherhood, doesn't he?
No, that's backwards. I mean, we do get some idea of who God is from his creatures, his creation, but everything in God is a prime analogy for all these realities. And so we can't equate God with human fatherhood in all its finitude and all its sinfulness in a fallen world. Nevertheless, you know, insofar as the Father is meant to be nourishing and taking an initiative and protecting, that yes, that God is a Father in that way. But we are the image of Him. He's not the image of us.
It strikes me, just from what we said there, that, and this is stepping out of the book to ask you, Father, is evangelism very, very hard with young people,
yes,
who grew up with no fathers?
Yes, exactly. And that's, you think about the difficulty of faith in our time when children in their earliest years are exposed to such corrosive material. In fact, just to put a little add in here, Mark, Ignatius Press is starting Ignatius Book Fairs around the country, because children are now being exposed to this gender of affirmation attack, to queer theory and so on, at the youngest ages. And yeah, what happens when there's no father? You want to have some masculine activities as a boy anyway, and so you form a gang. And then mothers have to work, home, you know, a married mother has to work. Child has no one at home. So, yes, faith is very difficult, and that's one reason, you know, we have things like First Things on one level, and you have catechisms on another level. We want to try and reintroduce people to reality, you know, of what a family is, what man and woman are meant to be, and therefore give them a chance to have a sense of God based on, you know, good human models.
The later chapter goes, one of the later pieces by Cardinal Seurat talks about the way in which Benedict would give speeches, and that he would almost know this speech is going to be distorted and it's going to be ridiculed. He at one point, Cardinal Seurat says, the world tried to gag him. What were there certain things that Benedict stated that, let's just say, the secular press ran with as abominations?
They tried to, but he was very shrewd. And he had this kind of German mind where things would be organically expressed. In fact, in his seminars we used to have with him, he'd let us talk, make us talk the whole time. He wouldn't say anything. At the end, he'd sum it up in two or three long German sentences, but kind of included everything we'd said in our seminar. And so when he spoke, he spoke druckfähig, they say in German, ready to print. So it was very hard to twist or take his words out of context because he included the context in what he said. And I think that's a problem with people who speak in place of authority. We have it in our country. We have it in the church. You've got to know not just what you're saying, but how it's going to be received and treated by the press. You know,
yeah.
Who am I to judge? Well, you know, you just can't say something like that without a otherwise it becomes a shibboleth.
And the press is going to take it and use it for its own its own agenda.
Yeah, we know it's
not hostile. Report.
Yeah,
exactly.
We know it's hostile. We have to when we say things, we have to say them. In I made a mistake myself one day on a radio show, where I said, the Jews are the cause of the sin of the Jews is the cause of the death of Jesus. But that was in the context that all our sins are causing the death of Jesus, you know, and therefore the Jews as well. But of course, what was taken out of that? Says the Jews caused the death of Jesus, you know. Well, okay.
Right.
I learned my lesson. It was a long time ago. Not that followed what I learned, but.
You know, we all get burned if we're going to stick our necks out, you know, to mix metaphors there for a moment.
Yeah.
The handling. One chapter addresses Benedict's handling of the sex abuse crisis. What does Cardinal Seurat say about that? That actually comes around ultimately to an issue of relativism. But what does he say?
Well, in terms of responding to the crisis, Cardinal Seurat makes clear that Ratzinger Benedict was in the forefront of trying to stem this tide and bring to justice those who had perpetrated these terrible evils. Before we finish the talk, though, the podcast, though, Mark, I want to say one thing about the book, that it's called, a witness to, a testimony of Benedict XVI, and it's beautifully done in three parts. As you know, it's the first part where Cardinal Seurat, who knew Benedict well and was kind of a student of his, spent a lot of time with him, gives what he thinks is a spiritual portrait of Benedict, which I think is a very beautiful way of describing the heart of this holy man. And in the second part of the book, he gathers together some of the tributes that were given, after the death of Benedict, which gives you different perspectives on Benedict from different people. It's kind of like walking around the Statue of David in Florence, where you can't see the whole statue just by looking at the front. You got to walk around it. And then he ends the book with several homilies by Benedict, which are probably not as well known, but again, express different facets of his spirituality. So the book really is a comprehensive whole. It gives you a picture of who Benedict really was at the heart of his life and the heart of his activity.
What does Cardinal Seurat himself remembers that Benedict's resignation struck him and others as a kind of Good Friday? What did he mean by that?
Well, it was suffering because they admired him and they thought he was a great leader of the church and holy man, and to see him resign the papacy was quite a blow. Although they should have known it was coming, because when Peter Zewald interviewed Ratzinger a few years before, and Benedict, who's still Pope, Zewald asked him, well, could a Pope ever retire? And immediately, this is one of those interviews where Ratzinger speaks off the cuff, but he speaks ready to print. And he said, look, if a Pope ever believed that his physical or psychological or spiritual powers were not up to the test, he not only could resign, he must resign. And as soon as I read that, I said, unless he dies suddenly, he will resign. Because he's a humble man. He's not there to grasp power or to be in charge of things. He never wanted to be a Pope or a cardinal or even a bishop. He wanted to pray, study, and write. But he did that You know, I think he was called to do it, but he did it only because he thought that was something that God was asking him to do.
Right. You know, he included here is a 1990 speech in which Cardinal Ratzinger at the time speaks of how at that moment, 1990, the church is held in low regard, even by Catholics. Now, this is several years into John Paul's term. Was there something specific happening at that time that he that was in the back of his mind?
Well, let's see. You're asking. You always ask what's in people's minds, Mark. And I only know what they're saying, but what did he mean by that in 1990?
Well, maybe. I mean, where was the church in 1990?
Well,
at that time, that, I mean, the wall had fallen in Berlin. I you know, wouldn't we see the Catholic Church riding a little higher than that?
Mark, I'm an old man now, and I lived through the 90s and 80s and 70s and 60s and 50s. And so I grew up before the council, when you didn't have to lock your car when you rode your bike to school, you know, when pornography wasn't surrounding you on all sides, where, you know, words like homosexuality or abortion weren't even known to young people. And then I lived through the 60s and the 70s in the church after the council. And I would say the confusion after the council was palpable everywhere. Anybody who lived through the 70s and then the 80s saw the church in decline. People leaving religious orders, people getting divorced, married. It was a time of great confusion in the church. And so therefore, by 1990, we're up on the upswing, because in 78, of course, we got John Paul II, but it took him a while before, you know, he could have his influence felt around the church. So I can see how in 1990, some people have a poor view of the church. Look what's happened. It's collapsed. Its moral authority has been undermined.
Yeah. I think with
the long papacy of John Paul II and then of Benedict, I think we had a great resurgence and a revival. And by the way, I'll just say this, Mark. I think church in America is very, very strong compared to Europe. Africa, I think, has great hope, vocations, and strong family life. But we have Mark Bauerlein at First Things. We've got 600 Catholic radio stations. We've got Catholic homeschooling. We've got a Catholic school resurgence. We've got good young bishops and priests. So I'm very encouraged about what's happening here.
You mentioned Africa. It is very gratifying to Cardinal Seurat that Pope Benedict gave so much attention to the African churches. Was that rather unprecedented before Benedict?
Well, I think Paul VI spoke very highly of Africa. I don't know if he went there or not, but I don't think it was unprecedented, but it was certainly emphasized greatly by Benedict, who did appreciate the faith in Africa, yes. And of course, we had the two great figureheads for me of English-speaking Africa, Cardinal Francis Arendse, whom Cardinal Ratzinger and Pope Benedict really admired. And then for French-speaking Africa, you have Cardinal Seurat, really two exemplary men of the church. And by the way, you've heard of diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Well, the Catholic Church is the greatest organization for that. Think about this. A young boy from rural Guinea, people don't even know where that is, becomes a cardinal of the Catholic Church. You know, how does that happen? And he's black, right? And he's poor. Anyway, people need to know that the real model for true diversity and true inclusion is the Roman Catholic Church.
Everyone Go lines ahead. Up in the same line.
Yep.
You know? So, final question, Father. How do you think Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger, will go down in history? How will he be remembered?
I will tell you this, what I think. 2 days after his death, on January 2nd, is the feast of Basil and Gregory Nazianzen, two great fathers of the church and doctors of the church of the 4th century, which is the century of the great Arian confusion. And Basil's brother was another great, Gregory Nyssa. Those three men were bulwarks in the midst of tremendous confusion of the 4th century. And they became fathers and doctors of the church. I believe that Father Henri de Lubac, whose cause had been introduced, Hanzo son Balthazar, his student, and Ratzinger, all three friends, all three worked together, all three corresponded. I believe that they'll go down eventually as both saints, doctors of the modern church. I really do.
The three major Catholic thinkers of the 20th century.
I would say
so. And a little beyond.
Yep.
Very good. The book is He Gave Us So Much, a tribute to Benedict XVI. Father Fessio, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. God bless you.